Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Private Attorneys and Qualified Immunity Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On January 17, 2012, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Filarski v. Delia. The question in this case is whether a lawyer retained to assist government employees with an internal affairs investigation may, in a subsequent lawsuit against the lawyer arising out of the lawyer's conduct during the investigation, assert the qualified immunity defense available to government employees in such circumstances. To discuss the case, we have Scott Martin, who is an associate in the D.C. office of Gibson, Dunn, and Crutcher. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Martin.
Hi, this is Scott Martin. I'm an attorney at Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher in Washington, D.C. with their Supreme Court and Appellate Litigation Practice Group, and I'm here to talk today about the Supreme Court's recent oral argument in Filarski v. Delia. Before I begin, I should mention that any opinions I express don't necessarily represent the views of Gibson, Dunn or its clients. Filarski is a case that involves the extent to which private actors, in this case an individual attorney, who act in conjunction with the government can benefit from a particular type of immunity that government officials enjoy. By way of background, and this is probably familiar to you already, but Section 1983 allows lawsuits for violations of federal constitutional rights by state actors or those acting under color of state law. And there's an immunity to Section 1983 called qualified immunity that would protect individuals in circumstances where constitutional rights are not clearly established. So if at the time of the alleged violation, the government official wasn't on notice of a clearly established right, then the suit would be barred by qualified immunity. And over a series of cases in recent years, the Supreme Court has addressed the extent to which that same qualified immunity applies to private actors. And it can come up in a number of situations. You can imagine, for instance, private prison guards. In the Filarski case, private lawyers acting in conjunction with the government. The case turns largely on an interpretation of an earlier decision called Richardson v. McKnight, which involves the private prison guard context. And the holding of that decision was that private prison guards do not benefit from qualified immunity, at least when they're not closely supervised by the government. It was a 5-4 opinion written by Justice Breyer, a dissent by Justice Scalia. Justice Breyer's opinion was joined by Justices Stevens, O'Connor, Souter, and Ginsburg. Justice Scalia's dissent joined by the late Chief Justice Rehnquist, Kennedy, and Thomas. It's interesting, and we'll note as we get later into the discussion, that some commentators have noted that of the members of the dissent, three of them are still on the court, whereas only two of the majority. They've discussed the extent to which that might bear and how the Filarski case came out. The reasoning of the court was basically that there was no evidence of immunity for private prison guards at common law, and that the purpose of qualified immunity, which is to make sure that government officials aren't deterred and enacting where appropriate, adequately be served by market price pressures, as private prison companies would want to do the best job possible in order to get hired given competition in this market. But it specifically distinguished situations where there was close supervision by the government. It said in Richardson there was limited direct supervision. Effectively, it was the state, Tennessee in that case, had taken sort of a hands-off approach to working with the private prison company. And so it said, well, maybe there would be a different case where there was close supervision. Justice Scalia, as I mentioned, dissented and argued that it shouldn't matter whether you're private or public as long as the function you're performing is a governmental function. So that sets the stage for Richardson, which deals, at least arguably, with the exception carved out in Richardson where there is a close relationship between the private actor and the government. In Richardson, the town of Rialto, California, engaged a private attorney, Filarski, to conduct and provide advice about an internal affairs investigation into a firefighter whose work absences had come under attention. He engaged in this investigation, and in the course of it, they discovered that the firefighter had purchased lumber, the use of which would allegedly be inconsistent with the work injury sustained and used as a basis for not showing up to work. And as part of the investigation, they brought Delia in and interviewed him, Filarski, along with two other folks at the fire department, and asked questions about it. And Delia's explanation was that he did purchase the lumber, but hadn't used it to complete the construction project. Filarski's response to that was, well, we'd like to verify that. Can you take us to your house and show us the lumber? At which point, Delia's attorney interjected, and said that that would be an unconstitutional search and a violation of Mr. Delia's constitutional rights. Florsky said, well, fine, as an alternative, we'll come to your house and you can bring the lumber out to us. Delia's attorney still objected and said, you know, this is a violation of the Fourth Amendment. You can't use this sort of subterfuge. And if you proceed with this, we will sue the fire department and find a way to sue you, Mr. Florsky. Florsky continued and persuaded the fire chief to sign an order compelling Mr. Delia to produce the unused lumber just outside the house. The chief went to the house and observed the lumber, which it turns out was unused. And as threatened or promised, Mr. Delia then responded by filing a lawsuit, not just against the fire department and its employees, but also against Mr. Filorski. The Ninth Circuit decided that there was no clearly established constitutional right at issue, and therefore, on the basis of qualified immunity, said the lawsuit as against the government employees must be dismissed. But against Filorski, the Ninth Circuit said, the lawsuit could proceed because he was a private actor, and therefore, under Richardson and other cases, the court reasoned, he would not have the benefit of qualified immunity. The case went up to the Supreme Court from the Ninth Circuit, like 32% of the court's cases this year. And the briefing focused, interestingly, on the scope of Richardson, and in particular, this exception for working closely with the government. The attorneys for Florsky did not call for Richardson to be overruled, but argued that it simply didn't apply where you have close coordination with the government as part of a central government activity. And the theory they argued was that civil service traditionally was filled by part-time workers, in the lawyer context in particular. Abraham Lincoln had prosecuted cases. John Marshall and others represented the government even when they were engaged in private practice. And therefore, the types of activities that the government employees would perform often had been performed by folks in the private sector. In addition, Filorski's counsel argued that the same concerns that you would have with deterring government action would apply equally when the government action is undertaken by private actors. And so, unlike in the context of Richardson, where there was limited oversight and it wasn't really, you know, the government acting, Filorski argued, well, this is government action and equally should be protected by immunity. Delia, as you might expect, relied on Richardson and argued that the same type of marketplace pressure concerns that had been raised in Richardson were applicable also to attorneys, that there's competition in the market for attorneys, and you could equally expect that to cause them to vigorously assert rights on behalf of the government, just as you would expect marketplace pressures and the competition for private prisons to ask them to have the prisons do a good job of controlling the prisoners. Delia's counsel also argued as a historical matter that there was no basis for distinguishing between cases where there's close supervision and cases where, as in Richardson, there's comparatively limited supervision. The government, for its part, sided with Filorski and also argued that Richardson wasn't controlling and could be distinguished on the reasoning laid out also by Filorski. And so as the case goes to the Supreme Court, there's an interesting three-way divide between Richardson's approach and extended to the situation it said was not before it, which is sort of close supervision and coordination between the two, and the opposite approach articulated by Justice Scalia, where as long as the function being performed is the type of function the government performs, then immunity applies. And then the sort of middle ground opinion where Richardson applies where there is limited government oversight, but otherwise immunity would govern where you have closer government oversight. Now, that middle ground became the subject of a number of questions early in the argument. In fact, the first question was by Justice Ginsburg, who pushed Filorski's counsel on whether they would actually have embraced a broader approach that would provide for immunity in, you know, many other cases involving private attorneys or others, even where there wasn't close supervision. And Filorski was careful not to reject the broader approach, but said, you know, for purposes of this case, it's enough for the court to apply immunity where there is close supervision, although it might also apply to these other cases. And then this led to an exchange that involved, among others, the Chief Justice and Justice Alito about whether the test close supervision could actually be applied and how much assurance that would give to private individuals. And then it also led to an interesting discussion, again involving Justice Alito and the Chief Justice, about independent investigators, for instance, where the job of the lawyer was to maintain independence from the government. Would that still be a basis for qualified immunity? And if not, wouldn't it raise the same practical problems? Filorski responded to that, that in all cases of lawyers, there are duties to the client and you're representing the client, and that that would be sufficiently close a supervision to warrant immunity. The difficulty of maintaining that line, or at least the potential difficulty, led Justice Scalia to interject that perhaps the rule should be, as he suggested in Richardson, if the individual can be sued by acting under color of state law, which, as I mentioned, is the requirement for Section 1983 suit, then the individual should also have any defenses that would be available, whether private or public actor. And several other justices followed along the same lines of inquiry. The Chief Justice, as I mentioned, suggested, well, you know, why does this distinction between the employees and not employees actually matter? And so during Daley's argument, there was a lot of questions about whether he could actually maintain this distinction between government employees and those who are doing the same things as government employees, but only as independent contractors. And there was a line of inquiry from Justices Scalia and Alito about your part-time employee for 1 month or 6 months or 1 year. And they pursued this line of inquiry for a while until Justice Breyer made an interesting practical observation, which is that the attorneys would have professional ethical reasons for providing the advice that you, the government actor I'm advising, can do this because the law is not clearly established and therefore you not be held liable. But then the private attorney could then be held liable and under joint and several liability could potentially be responsible for the entire judgment. And so the discussion then turned to some of the practical consequences of what a decision rejecting immunity would mean, and in fact prompted the Chief Justice to state that this case actually highlights why immunity might be necessary. The argument then turned to some of the historical issues. Justice Kagan asked whether there'd be any historical basis for extending qualified immunity in this context, expressed some trouble with the court's private actor immunity cases, arguing that there would always be no historical basis, and therefore the entire line of cases might be unfounded, at which Justice Alito responded that there's actually a mix of history and policy that might justify them. Justice Sotomayor also seemed skeptical of some of these historical and other arguments, suggesting that, you know, maybe here there was not adequate supervision, or maybe it would be sufficient for the attorney's professional responsibilities to control the behavior. And so as this suggests, it was sort of a wide-ranging argument, starting with some of the potential difficulties in maintaining a middle ground position and then moving on to potential difficulties with either of the other two alternatives, expanding Richardson or narrowing it. As I mentioned earlier, you know, we know that three members of the dissent in Richardson are still on the court, and assuming that they maintain the view that they had in Richardson, and combining that with the Chief Justice's suggestion that this case highlights why immunity might be warranted, appears that there are at least several votes to reverse the Ninth Circuit, and possibly joined by Justice Alito's, if his suggestion that there might not be sensible distinction between part-time employees and independent contractors. So the issue then is which route the court takes within these three possible ways forward. And it seems potentially interesting that Justice Breyer expressed such skepticism about the practical effects of not applying immunity here. As you'll recall, he wrote the majority opinion in Richardson, and if he is sufficiently troubled by the practical concerns raised by rejecting qualified immunity here, then perhaps, you know, even he might be persuaded to say that, you know, Richardson does not apply to a case where there is sufficiently close supervision of the private actor by the government. And on that point, you know, suggest that there could potentially be a broader consensus coalescing around that view, and perhaps not addressing, or at least not addressing except in concurring opinions, the broader issue about to what extent Richardson should be maintained or expanded in other directions. So we will see over the next couple months. An opinion is expected likely by the end of June, if not before, and it should prove to be very interesting.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.